Welcome to the High Performance Half Hour with me, David Osgathorpe. Each week, we meet with athletes, coaches, business owners, and entertainers to discuss the high-performing habits that have led to their individual success. On the show today, we have a former Olympic rower, Hans Dresinger, whose 12-year sporting career culminated in him being a member of the 2016 USA rowing team in Rio. In this episode, we discuss his life in the boat, his successes and failures, and how he's transitioning from sport into a new career in real estate in the San Francisco Bay Area. This was a really enjoyable conversation for me, and I hope you guys get a lot from it too. Hans, thank you for joining us today. How are you?
David, it's an honor to be here. Thanks for having me. I'm doing well.
Good stuff. Listen, there's a lot that I kind of want to get through today, but do you want to just tell us what you're up to now and the various projects that you're involved in?
Gosh. Yeah, I'd love to. So first and foremost, I'm a realtor partner with the Gunderman Group here in the Bay Area. So the San Francisco Bay Area, we're on the east side of the Bay. So Oakland, Berkeley, that area, we sell a lot of houses and we're fortunate to be the number one team in the East Bay by volume. So that's a big part of my day and my existence right now. And obviously, I also have a podcast, which is more or less how you and I got connected, called Another Way to Play, which is about to air episode 130, if you can believe it. It's kind of crazy. It's that many. Wow. And then I'm also a co-founder in a startup company called Streamlined Podcasts, where our mission is to keep podcasters podcasting with basically the highest quality, most affordable post-production services on the market right now. And that is growing like crazy. And it's getting more and more of my attention and is a ton of fun as well.
Okay. So do you know what? That was something that I was going to speak to you personally about, because having seen the post-production and how you kind of put all of your editing in place, I was guessing someone else was doing that. Mm-hmm. So maybe we can talk about that another time, Hans. Anyway, yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, just as you know, or anyone who's listening who's ever tried to edit something, it's crazy. And we believe that's one of the biggest reasons why people don't get their voice out and don't make it past, you know, 7 or 10 episodes, is because it's hard or it's expensive. And, you know, there are ways to make it that it's not, that's not the prohibiting factor. So that's our goal.
Yeah. It's like a ridiculous number of podcasts that have been started, but like a fraction of them that go beyond 10 episodes, I think.
Yeah,
it's madness, isn't it?
Of the 600,000 or whatever podcasts are in iTunes right now, 200,000 or 300,000 haven't uploaded anything in the last 90 days. And I think it's something like half haven't made it over 7 or 8 episodes. Yeah. I don't know exactly the stat, but it's something like, it's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, look, we'll revisit this another time then. Okay.
But yeah, for sure.
There's a lot going on there, but I kind of want to just touch upon a previous career. This is kind of your second lease of life. Mm-hmm. I know you've got a previous career where you started actually competed for the US in the men's 8 rowing. So do you want to tell us when that started, where it led to, how long that career kind of went for?
Yeah, it's odd to sort of be 31 and be on a second career, right? But yeah, I in my previous life, I was all about athletics and athletic performance in the sport of rowing. And that all started when I was 13 or 14 in the Seattle, Washington area. Anyone who's ever visited knows there's a strong rowing culture because there's water everywhere. Mm-hmm. And we as a family got into it, as someone just gave us a tip that you could go take private rowing lessons as like a summer activity. And so my parents signed up for that for a couple of lessons. And long story short is I got kind of pulled into the junior program during the summer, kind of liked that. And then just join the fall team and then came back for the spring team. Cause it's all club. It's very little of it's with your school. And, just kind of fell in love with the sport after that first year and just kept going to the next level slowly but surely. And I think it's important to know that, you know, I didn't start out as a total stud. Like I was in the 3V, you know, the third varsity boat. I was not the biggest guy by any means. I'm pretty big now, but even by rowing standards, I'm not particularly big. And, you know, I grew a lot in that sport physically and, you know, in all the other ways one can grow from the age of 13 till college. And learned a lot of lessons along the way, had a lot of successes, many failures as well. And I'm sure we'll unpack a bunch of those. But ultimately, it was a 12-year career that culminated as a member of the men's eight in Rio de Janeiro for the United States.
Amazing. That's really fascinating that you kind of talk about being in the, you know, the third, but what would you have been sort of, you know, mid-teens at that stage when you were sort of, you know, maybe not exactly 14, setting the world on fire?
15, yeah. 14, 15 world, you know, by the time I was 15, or when I got my license, I was starting to figure it out and starting to develop physically because, you know, rowing is an all year round, very physically demanding sport. And so your body changes because you put on muscle, you lean out, you know, whatever. It's like you're you grow, right? So there was a point at which I definitely did that, but in the very beginning I didn't like the sport very much. It was really hard. It was boring sitting on the rowing machine. You name it, I had every complaint or excuse about it. And luckily, all the older kids who I was kind of looking up to at the time, because I actually went to a very small private high school. My graduating class was 82, and I had been at that school since first grade, and I graduated high school from there. And so my world socially was quite small. And then I joined the rowing team, and I got to meet kids from literally every major high school in the region, you know, with probably a 20-mile radius almost through competition and practice and what have you. And it just blew my mind of like all these different ways of looking at the world and lifestyles and what have you. But anyways, they convinced me that I had to stick around until the spring, and I'm glad I did because I caught the bug, and you know, the rest is history.
Yeah, amazing. I think it's like that sliding doors moment, isn't it? Where would life have taken you had you not just kind of stuck with it that little bit longer?
Yeah, there's always those forks in the road when you look back, and they don't necessarily feel like forks in the road. You know, they're admittedly, like, my dad was really good at kind of keeping me engaged in sports. It's like, if you're going to start the season, you're going to finish this season because you made a commitment to your teammates, you made a commitment to yourself, you know, you see it through. And you know, up until the point that there's like actually something wrong, you're physically hurt, or the coach is a really bad jerk who's like abusing kids, which happened on a football team that I was a part of as a fifth grader. And anyways, so I got out of that sport early, but everything else I saw through to the end because, you know, he and my mom both really instilled that in me actually. From an early age, that like you start what you finish, or you finish what you start.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, look, so important to have those, you know, key messages and mentors around in your life. I get that was powerful to have that. That's just such a good message for life, though, isn't it? Really, to finish what you start. I think we're all a little bit too flow. I mean, like a subject we just talked about with the people with the podcasts, you know. I mean, that's such a common theme, I think, now. And you know, the persistence to stick with something there. I mean, the rewards that you've obviously reaped beyond that. Have probably come down to that mindset.
You know, it's interesting. I was doing a workout this morning. My wife's a personal trainer, also an Olympian, and she parlayed that into her work and now has a very successful practice as a personal trainer and health coach. And we work out almost every morning together, and we were on our cool down run, and I was coming back on the very end of the cool down run and kind of thinking like, you know, I knew I was going to be on this podcast today, but also, you know, I put out content myself. I got my own show. I have a YouTube channel. I do all that different stuff, and I go on other podcasts. I'm like, man, like, what can I tell people that would help them really? And my answers always go to like, trying, in the case of real estate, for example, reading the contract that you use, the standard purchase agreement that you use, and really becoming a master of that document and, you know, really understanding the nuances of different disclosure items and various things. Every industry has them, and just becoming just an absolute master of those types of things. But that's not the get rich fast model. It will absolutely compound over time, and you start to do a really good job for one client, then they'll tell another and another, and then before you know it, you've got referrals coming in every week because you've just been killing it regularly for all these great people. But that's not going to get a lot of likes on Instagram. So there's kind of this conflicting two sides of the message. That's like, okay, I want leads now. I want likes now. I want whatever now. And we all need that. And we all, I mean, to some degree, you kind of have to have that to make some noise in the crowded space online. But the substance often isn't there. Like I click on stuff all the time, and I take meetings with salespeople all the time who are, you know, trying to sell me something for my business, because I'm always interested in what's going on out there. Yeah. And they get in front of me effectively, but then the substance is garbage, and it's like, there's nothing there for me. And then they just badger me and follow up and send me DMs and whatever. And they don't provide me any real value. There's nothing of, they don't take the time to like get to know me and like understand what I'm trying to accomplish in my business. And, you know, you name it, it's there. Like I'm constantly let down by that kind of stuff. And it's really just like, oh my gosh.
Yeah. Do you know what? I mean, it is that whole, like you said, the Instagram likes, it is a world where we want that instant gratification. And I think, like, had someone said to you at sort of, you know, 14 years of age, okay, in 12 years time, if you work hard enough, you're going to achieve the pinnacle here, you know, you'd gone, what? You know, I think it's a whole different kind of mentality that's required, that as a, that daily grind of kind of, and well, look, I mean, it's maybe not necessarily a daily grind, because I know that's a message that you kind of, you know, try and push away from. However, when it's doing something that you do really enjoy, it doesn't seem like the grind, but it is that continuous daily efforts, that compound effect that does get somewhere. But actually, you know, if we can avoid that, see, you know, that need for the instant gratification, there's a lot of joy beyond that, isn't there?
Yeah, you know, it's there's a book I'm reading right now, I'm almost done with it. It's The Psychology of Money by Morgan Housel. I'm not sure. I totally probably screwed his name up, but awesome book. And one of the big principles, he doesn't talk about like investment strategy per se. He talks about like the way human beings interact psychologically and emotionally around money. And it's fascinating. I'm going to probably reread it when I'm done, because there's just so much good stuff in there that you can learn. And one of the biggest lessons I'm taking away, which is, you know, applicable to investing, but is also applicable to a skill learning, is what you just said, is that compound effect. Like if you can stay in the game long enough to compound your effort or your money or whatever, that's when you get to a level of mastery that no one else can just touch. You know, Kobe Bryant, you know, passed away recently and was quoted. I remember watching a video or reading something where he was just saying like, I go into the gym an extra hour every day or 6 days a week instead of five or whatever it was, because that gets me an extra blah hours per year. And if I do that for 5 years, nobody is going to be able to catch me because I'm going to be so far ahead. And like, that's the exact mentality that I think we should start taking. So like when you're posting on Instagram and your thing doesn't get a bunch of likes, or, you know, you're learning a skill and you fumble and you lose a client or whatever, it's not that you failed. It's just you're early on in your career. And if you can figure out those ways to stay in the game and keep learning and growing, like success is basically inevitable at that point.
Yeah. Okay. This is fascinating. I love this kind of talk. You know, I am a big fan of Kobe Bryant and that whole kind of approach there. I'm fascinated to know, has this always been your mindset? Did you have this at a young age when you kind of, you know, in your previous career?
No. because I didn't need to. And when I say that, I mean, when you're young, you've always got like that next thing. It's like, go to college, you know, graduate high school first, you know, make the varsity team. And then you like go to college, and then it's like, okay, graduate college or make the varsity team there or win the championship there. Or, you know, there's like those kind of next milestones. And then for me, it was, by the time I was part of the way through college, it was really clear that I wanted to continue rowing at a high level after college, because I was at University of Washington, where I went. We have an international talent pool that comes to school there. And I was competing and beating many or most of those guys who were on their various national team and Olympic teams for their countries. So I was just like, you know, I can do this. And there was always that like next step. But as soon, to your point about like the two career thing, you know, as soon as rowing was over, I didn't know it was over at the time until later. But I got done with Rio, came home, knew I was going to take some time off. So I needed to kind of start my career to some degree, and got into real estate. And it was supposed to be very flexible, and which it was. And long story short, I just decided not to go back to rowing. But at the time, like through rowing, there was always a very clearly defined next step and a next hurdle and a next whatever. Whereas here in quote unquote real life, or business life, it's especially with a sort of an entrepreneurial engagement, it's not so clear, and no one is putting that, track in front of you. Like the Olympics are really freaking easy for decision making, because you know you're not going to that wedding, you're not going to have another beer and stay out another hour later. Because you got to get up and you got to get after it the next morning, and you know all those like when you go to sleep, what you eat, how much you eat. It's literally decisions have been made for you, and it's just a matter of, do you want to get on that track or not? Whereas now it's like I've had to cultivate this mentality that we just talked about a few minutes ago over the last couple of years, which has frankly been really challenging, because I was at the top of something. I was really, really good at it. You know, basically the top of the world in that thing. And, you know, and then you come back down to reality and you're a newbie again, and you have no strong direction, no North Star anymore. So you got to kind of figure that one out.
Oh, look, definitely. I mean, look, it's something we briefly touched upon before we hit record on here. But it is that whole I find it so often with people when they're transitioning from one career to the next, and particularly with athletes, it is that loss of identity initially, and how you kind of manage that, because it isn't just a new job. It's a whole new way of life, a whole new way of looking at everything, and you know, a whole new way of other people looking at you. And I mean, how did you initially deal with that?
So I'll break this down in a couple steps here. Immediately after, so in Rio, we were not necessarily the gold medal favorite, but we definitely had the shot at a medal to get on the podium. And we go into the A final, and long story short, we did not have our best race, and we ended up fourth. So pretty heartbreaking at the moment. And basically, I internalized that story as we failed, and that means I failed, and that means I'm a failure. And I literally carried that thought with me for about a year and a half afterwards. Wow. And it really affected, and because I had, in my beginning stages of real estate, just this residual, you know, hard work, mentality, and like, I could really grind things out and do uncomfortable stuff for a long period of time. I had success. And so, but I wasn't necessarily feeling good about it. I just kind of was doing it because that's what I knew what to do. And then I eventually saw a therapist for a while. I also separately got a life coach, who in that process, I don't recall which one of them specifically, but, the thought of like, are you going to let 5.5 minutes, the result of a 5.5 minute race, define your 12 plus year rowing career?
Wow.
Because if you are, and you're pretty logical, that sounds pretty stupid, but that's effectively what I was doing. And I had won a lot of races. I had 2 national championships in college and 2 silver medals in college. And, from the national championships, and we were within, you know, quarter of seconds on both of those, you know, it was close. And so I, you know, and then in event in the national team, I had set a lot of various personal records and been part of some really good boats and had some good successes and made a lot of friends, a lot of great opportunities. I was the guest of the People's Republic of China to go row there once. Wow. For like this I had like these crazy, yeah, experiences as a result of everything. And so just to call that a failure, I was like, that's dumb. That does not make sense. That's not me. I don't want that. And so I really said, yes, like we did get fourth, and we did not hit our goal, but that doesn't mean that we failed or I'm a failure because of all this other amazing stuff that happened. And reshaping that identity really helped me. Honestly, that was the first step on the path to like building this new identity that we're talking about now. And, fast forward a couple more years and some more reps and challenges and disappointments, you know, but here we are with it.
Do you know, it's really interesting hearing you list those things. I'm guessing that at the time it was just ticking off and moving on to the next stage and what's next. Did you ever sort of take the time to congratulate yourself, to give yourself that pat on the back, to kind of say, wow, look at what I have achieved as you went? Or was it always, okay, back in the boat, what's next?
There were moments of both. Our team, you know, during the season, in college, for example, we won the majority of our races. And I think my personal winning percentage was like almost 80% of all the races I lined up for, we won. And so, and there were guys who had 100% winning percentages on, you know, that I rode with. So we had a really strong team, while I was there and after I left. And there was a mentality that we carried, which was to not get too heady, not to get too full of yourself, you know, because the next race, the national championship's the one that matters.
Yeah.
But there were opportunities to, you know, really sink into that, like, how cool is this? Like, we're really doing this kind of thing, which I think I took advantage of in a lot of ways. And then on the national team, you know, same thing, because we were unproven. We didn't, especially once the boat was named, we were kind of this hodgepodge second priority boat, that, you know, was a bunch of young college guys and two guys who had been around a little longer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so we tried to carry a very humble mentality, but I do remember a couple of times specifically we were rowing, we broke the eight boat down into 2 4-person boats. And we're rowing along on the lake in Princeton, New Jersey, where we were training. And there was just this moment, the water was perfectly flat. There was no wind and we were hitting a speed, and we trained based on gold medal standard. And basically at every cadence, every stroke, every different stroke per minute has a different speed. If you're hitting that, you're on quote gold medal standard. And we were at or below that the entire lap. And I wow, remember thinking to myself, I said this out loud in the boat. I was like, let's shut up for a second and just take this in. Like, this is as good as the sport gets right now. And I still go back to that and be like, we're at it. This is the peak of this sport in this boat class is what we're doing right this second. And it was really a cool moment. And so yes, I've had those moments, but those weren't the predominant experiences for sure.
Yeah. Do you try to find that joy in the moment a little bit more now?
Yeah. I'd like to think so. Especially so fast forward a couple of years into real estate, I was striving to make the 100 grand in a year, you know, the big threshold that everyone wants to hit their, you know, first or second year or whatever. And I didn't hit it my first 2 years. I was in the ballpark, but not quite. And my third year, I switched onto the team that I'm on now. And that's a separate story, but I got an opportunity to join the Gunderman Group, which is the most successful team in the East Bay. And I was like, okay, it can happen. But I didn't really believe it 100% because it hadn't happened yet. And then I remember in May of that first full year with them, I had a really big month. I had 3 closings that month, one of which was a $3 million home, which was just sick. And it was a cool, super cool house. And I got the opportunity to represent the buyer. And anyways, I kind of had the spreadsheet going and I was going to make like 60 or something thousand in commissions or something that month. So I was like, okay, this is going to happen. And then I'm barbecuing in our little backyard area. I checked my phone and the commissions had all hit my bank account. And I looked at the numbers and I was like, there they are. And it was like the biggest letdown of all time because I expected there to be some like trumpets and some like something really cool going, right? Like it was like the thing I had been going for. And I was like, okay, I'm going to hit it. It's like inevitable now. And that moment made me realize like, okay, it's like, that is the definition of it's not the destination, it's the journey. Mm-hmm. And so now I really do my best to, you know, sit in these moments of like these meetings that I'm in and these like little highs and lows and problems we solve and like, just take in as much as I can, you know, what is happening around me and be grateful for these opportunities and, you know, just enjoy the ride to some degree because, yeah. You know, the one thing I will say is like, now that I've had a few reps professionally and we have a few rental properties and we just bought a house and like we've knocked out a lot of the like firsts. Right. And so there's no more firsts and I will say me and my wife both were pretty awake at the wheel for those first moments. And I think that really made them feel really rich, even though at the time they were scary and really frustrating. Going forward now, like another rental property is not as big of a deal as that first one was. And another sale is not as big of a deal as that first one was. Right. So, anyways, so that's nice. Just to say I try to do that as much as I can.
No, I really like it. Do you still, you know, it's interesting how you talk with everything through there. And I think like those first, just what you sort of mentioned there, I was kind of reflecting back. I had this whole kind of process a couple of years ago where I was trying to win an award for my business. And it was, you know, this year long process and just imagining what it was going to be like. And we won and going up there, collected the award. It was like, wow. And then immediately after, literally immediately after, was this massive low. Is that it? And where do we go now? And I think that you kind of, yeah, exactly like you said, it's focusing, enjoying the journey rather than it being just about that destination and where do you go from beyond there. But what I just reading some of your materials, I kind of get the feeling that life is still a bit of a competition there and you are kind of seeking those challenges and, you know, just on your, I think you list yourself in the top 2% in East Bay and the top 10% in Northern California. Is that like a big thing still for you to have that competitive element there?
Of course. Yeah. I mean, I am competitive. There's no question about that. And that is never going to leave. And there's a level at which it's healthy. And then there's a level when it's like insane and it's not healthy. Right. So I do think it's important to sort of recognize what kind of person you are and how you thrive, because if I'm always trying to fight against that competition thing, I'm going to have internal conflict. That's just going to drain me. And so I keep track of my stats and I'm proud of the stats that I'm able to hit and I'm always measuring and stuff. But if I'm always measuring and like every time I meet someone, I'm like, hey, how much have you sold? And I'm like, oh, I've sold a lot. You know, that's where it crosses to unhealthy, right? Mm-hmm. So So I
does that come from you know, your athletic background with measuring? I'm sure you kept a few training diaries and bits and pieces over the years. Is that a constant thing from there?
Totally. And you know, I'm not proud to say this, but I definitely, in the sport of rowing, measured people based on their erg scores and their, like, what races they had won. And that was just the culture. Like, that's what you have to sort of, it's competition, it's pure competition, and that's what it is. And you almost measure people's value off of their performance, which sucks when you're the one being measured that way, but that's also the game we signed up for. And now in real life, it's more about, I try and make it more about finding what my level of competition is with myself, and like, where do I want the bar to be? And then how can I get over that bar personally, as opposed to I need to beat people. And that has been a really hard transition for me, but I'm starting slowly to get into it. And another big one is actually seeing my quote unquote competition as inspiration, as opposed to, you know, something negative that I need to, the enemy. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Mm. That's been hard, really hard.
No, I think that's fact. Is there anything else like that you kind of feel? I mean, look, I think sport, whether you're a former athlete or not, I think sporting analogies are great kind of reference points for business or for life, really. But is there anything like from your sporting background that you're glad you've left behind, whether that's just habits or behaviors or mindsets that you had at that time that you just think don't serve you anymore in this next stage?
Yeah, another one was, when I was training, like, training was number one, and competition and performance as a result was number one, and literally everything else was second, including my girlfriend at the time, including family, including social events, all of that. And I remember distinctly, my dad got remarried when I was, I think it was in 2015. So I was right in the middle of training.
Wow.
And they did a little private wedding and they live streamed it. So I caught the live stream, but I got to meet his wife a couple of times, but we were living in different places and stuff. So, and then I went to go, I think it was that Christmas or a holiday right after Rio. So 2016 or thereabouts. And after a couple of days, she's like, you know, I finally feel like I'm meeting you, because every time I met you physically, I don't think you were there. I think you had this like shield up, and
wow.
I was like, I mean, really, really did. And so I would like to think that is something I have discarded or don't use as often to hopefully be a little bit more open and authentic and less shielded, if you will. But I don't know, maybe you gotta talk to my wife and some of my friends to see if that one's right or not.
Do you know, I think we're probably all a little bit guilty of that. And I think, you know, you and obviously your mother-in-law obviously would understand the reasons why, but I think that's really hard hitting when someone actually says that to you, to kind of recognize, oh ouch,
I saw it as like and this is maybe the other semi-shameful thing, but like, I saw that as sort of a point of pride, frankly. And I was like, yeah, I was like, that's what I needed to be, though. That's the version of myself to make it to the Olympics. I had to guard. I had to like charge forward with a singular focus. I could not let anything else in. And, you know, it served me in that moment, but it will not continue to serve me in, you know, business and friendships and all that sort of stuff. Like, people get it when you're training for the Olympics, more or less, not everyone does. But like, if you're just that way as like a friend on Friday night, like no, people aren't going to stick around very long when you're acting that way.
Yeah, no, definitely. Definitely. Listen, is there, I like this message that you've kind of got, and it's interesting just speaking to you in here, because you've got this message like life defined by freedom. And I know that's kind of like the purpose with your podcast and a lot of the work that you do. And some people would look on the outside kind of thinking, well, this guy's working a lot, he's training a lot, he's kind of got a lot on. That doesn't feel like freedom. But how do you define freedom for yourself?
Great question. That is frankly a moving target. I don't define, you know, I had a podcast guest on named Blake Haxton. I don't recall which episode number it was, but 10 or 15 episodes ago, who is bound to a wheelchair because he had 18 years old. He had a near-death experience and 20 surgeries later through a flesh-eating wow. disease, lost one of his legs and part of another, or most of another. And just total freak thing. Like he was totally healthy otherwise. And now he is a Paralympian. He rows and he does canoe, kayak, and he also has a job as a financial analyst and such. Really cool guy. And I've tried to adopt his definition of freedom, which is like most people think freedom is sort of that financial, I can lay on a beach all day if I want to, like all of that stuff. And realistically, I mean, you might attain that at some point, but I think most of us would get pretty freaking bored of that life fairly quickly. And so he doesn't talk about freedom because he's physically bound to a wheelchair, but he talks about having the right constraints as opposed to like fighting against all or any constraints. Because he made the analogy of like, if a fish was on the beach, you wouldn't say that the fish is free of water. Right. Mm. Even though it technically is. So like finding those right constraints for you and like leaning into that. And for me, I find like my freedom would be, you know, not going into an office and being bound by 8 hours and a salary. Freedom right now currently is, you know, creating content that I like, having a schedule that I control more or less, like having a financial situation that I'm proud of, because I know that I'm going to continue to work for a handful of years more, if not, you know, 10 or 20, whether I choose to or not. So I may as well have those choices, and that having those correct constraints for me and the type of person I am, like that's how I'm defining freedom.
Do you know, I mean, this is where the power of the podcasting and the people that you're able to meet and the conversations that you're able to have because of that, that sounds like I'm going to actually dig out that episode, Hans, because that sounds really powerful. I think, you know, just to appreciate what you have in life and to kind of get a different perspective on how you look at life. That's what was the guy's name? Blake Haxton, did you say?
Blake Haxton. I don't remember. Let me see if I can pull it up.
No, I'll find it yeah. And I'll put it in the show notes for here as well. And I appreciate that. I think, look, I mean, with that in mind, I mean, it's, you've obviously got a different outlook on life now than you did when you were, you know, 20 years ago, or, you know, 15 years ago, when you were kind of, you know, really kind of going for it in an athletic setting. Is there anything that you would kind of go back and tell your 15 year old self now to do more of, do less of, kind of how to look at life in a slightly different way?
Honestly, no. Mm. My initial reaction is no, because it got like everything that let me say it this way. I've started a meditation practice and I now have 8 days straight. And before that I got 7 days straight, and I've been trying to
how long ago did you start this, Hans?
A couple of weeks. I'm talking less than a month for sure. And we're basically, I'm trying to spend at least 20 minutes every morning meditating. And this sort of came about because I had a poor relationship with my younger self. One thing that a lot of people don't know about me is I have two first names, and I used to go by Chris because Hans is a family name and I was one of the youngest cousins, and it would be confusing. So I got my second name. But I joined rowing and I became Hans, and I kind of shifted to this new identity, and now I'm Hans. And so for a long time, mentally, it was like that first 15 years, those formative years, I like pushed away really aggressively. And as a result, you know, didn't
good
really
analogy
like...
you've just used there, Hans. I don't know if you picked up on that. Yeah. Sorry, it's just literally and mentally what you were doing, pushing away, yeah?
Exactly. And, you know, it's so through this practice, I've started to basically like myself or like that younger self more. And so to answer your question, like, I don't know that I would change anything. And I don't know that, like, I like the idea of that question because it gives advice to people. But what my better advice is like, cultivate that something more mindful of the present, because the, you know, the sunk cost of your life, what you did previously got you here, and freaking out about it is not going to change that. And if you can become very, you know, more mindful and more grounded and present in today, you will find more peace with that. You will, you know, learn from your past and learn from your mistakes, positive and negative, and potentially be able to create a better present, which will hopefully lead to a better future for you. And so that's a really long way of saying, like, I don't know that I would necessarily change anything, other than I wish I would have started that sort of mindfulness practice and, like, being grounded and then bringing the path, what let what was be, sooner.
Yeah. It's something that I was introduced to a while ago, and like you, that's the beauty of, we should be a different version of ourselves, you know, 15, 20 years later. However, you know, it's a wonderful, you know, thing to be able to look back and wonder what if, or, you know, like you said, it's kind of part of the journey, isn't it, really? And actually, why would we change anything? Because it's brought us to where you are now and what you're doing now. And you've kind of got to appreciate all of those things that have come about. Have you got an app? Are you just, are you just spending some time on your own? Anything that you recommend on that?
Insight Timer. That's the one that I like to use. It's free, which is nice. And it's more of a platform where people can upload, you know, their pre-recorded stuff, and you can access that stuff for free. And there's a built-in timer with, you know, gongs and chimes, and you can set it for different background musics and stuff. And I do that one a lot too. But yeah, man, it's just, you know, just trying to be present and, you know, not worrying about the past or the future. Cause like the moment right now is what we have. And, you know, being present in those moments is really freaking hard. It turns out, but super worth it when you start to do it over and over and over again.
Definitely. Definitely. Listen, I just want to ask one more final question. Do you still get back on the water or back on the rowing machine on a regular basis?
Oh man, I felt really old the other day, because about 3-4 weeks ago, I was on the rowing machine. I hadn't touched it in a while. And I was doing this pretty high intensity workout, and I was on the last piece of the last set, and I blew my back out, and I've never done that in my entire 12-year career. And I was like, oh no, I am not what I used to be. So I don't get on the water except for maybe once or twice a year with some alumni or something row. And then I occasionally get on the erg, but I'm more into other athletic things at the moment, like, you know, doing circuits and running and some of that stuff.
Yeah, I think, like, just knowing your personality from this chat, I'm sure that would just be a constant battle, and knowing where you were and where you should be. And I guess it takes the enjoyment factor out of it slightly.
Yeah, I mean, I have had to retool when I do get on the erg. It's like, or in the boat, it's like, we're not training, you know, 20, 30 hours a week anymore. I train, you know, of an hour every day for various, you know, running or whatever, but I've had to retool my expectations and my judgment on the workout itself.
Brilliant. Listen, Hans, thank you so much for your time today. I've really enjoyed our conversation there. That's fascinating stuff. What's the day ahead looking like for you?
Well, first of all, thanks for the opportunity. It was an awesome chat. You had some great questions. Far as the day ahead goes, it's day before Thanksgiving today, and we are, and so it's a little lighter, but I've got, I've got a couple of meetings. I've had a couple of meetings this morning with my Streamline team, and then I've got a meeting with my VA here coming up in a few minutes. And then from there, it's just, I've got a couple of tasks to knock out. We're rebuilding a website, doing some stuff like that. And then I've got date night tonight. That's another thing I would recommend anyone in a relationship, carve out an evening every week and hold it religiously, because it is time well invested with your significant other.
Great advice, my friend. Listen, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. I'm going to follow up because you've just touched on a couple of things that I want to speak to you about personally. So I'll be in touch soon, if that's okay.
Absolutely. Well, appreciate this, David. An awesome show and great questions, and good luck to you.
Thank you, my friend. Likewise. Take care. We'll speak soon.